I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, Gilligan's Island has attained a status as one of the most beloved sitcoms in American television history. The premise was simple but brilliant. Seven castaways are stranded on a tropical island after their ship, the SS Minnow, is wrecked in a terrible storm. Needless to say, hijinks ensue as the seven wildly different and distinct characters attempt to escape the island. For many Americans, Gilligan's Island harkens back to a bygone era of innocent, wholesome family entertainment. And yet, what if, beneath that surface-level sheen of wholesome family entertainment, Gilligan's Island was doing something much more subversive or radical? What if Gilligan's Island was promoting the ideals of Karl Marx's communism? Now hold your horses, before you bust out the laugh track. This interpretation of the beloved sitcom is actually the thesis of acclaimed documentary filmmaker Kevin Soling's The Gilligan Manifesto. If you're not familiar with Kevin's work, his previous efforts include the documentaries A Hole in the Head, The War on the War on Drugs, and, perhaps most notably, The War on Kids, which made a harsh critique of the public schooling system in America and gained enough attention for Kevin to be interviewed on Comedy Central's The Colbert Report. You can hear more about that documentary on an upcoming edition of the Parallax Views After Hours program for Patreon supporters. On this edition of Parallax Views, however, Kevin and I will be talking about his documentary The Gilligan Manifesto, in which he argues that the classic TV sitcom Gilligan's Island was a representation of Karl Marx's ideal of communism. And now, on to this previously unpublished conversation with Kevin Soling. Welcome to Parallax Views, Kevin Soling.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good. So, Kevin, I wanted to have you on the show because you have this really fascinating documentary called The Gilligan Manifesto, which examines the sort of left-wing socio-political underpinnings of the now iconic sitcom Gilligan's Island. So I guess the first question I have is, you know, I think when Gilligan first debuted in the 60s, it was sort of seen as like a, you know, a kitschy show. It still is, but it's sort of taken on a life of its own. What led you to sort of revisit this sort of kitschy sitcom from the 60s?
Well, I love the show. I mean, I didn't see it when it first broadcast, but it's been perpetually in reruns, you know, ever since it first aired. And you know, I loved the show as a kid. And then, you know, at some point, you know, I started watching the reruns, and I just, you know, I just naturally kind of analyze and, you know, culture, consumer culture. And, you know, I was with my girlfriend at the time and was sort of breaking down, you know, the themes of what was sort of going on. And she told me, you know, you should really write that down. And, you know, I'm only marginally aware, you know, if I've stumbled on something that's kind of, you know, original, just cause it seems, you know, so many things just seem so obvious to me. And so I ended up, you know, writing up a paper that was, you know, an academic paper that got published in this journal of American popular culture, Americana. And I decided then later that it should really be a film, because Gilligan's Island itself is cinematic. And, you know, there's just this ongoing interest in Gilligan's Island. I still see, you know, all sorts of clickbait, you know, with references to Gilligan's Island, you know, online and stuff. So there's, you know, there's still an interest and awareness in it. And the spin and the interpretation of what is, you know, quite evidently going on fascinates a lot of people who just hadn't really considered it, because it presents itself as being slapstick humor.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I think it's pretty timely now, because we have a lot of debate in this country, especially in the Democratic Party, about, you know, you have a lot of Democrats in the base sort of wanting the party to move further leftward. You know, we have this sort of harkening back to the ideas of FDR and, you know, social democracy, maybe not communism per se, but a more leftward sort of a turn that a lot of people seem interested in, especially millennials. So could you sort of comment on that and how you see Gilligan's Island as, you know, having a sort of left-wing tilt to it?
Sure. I guess, you know, the realization, or my thesis, you know, of the film is that it actually transcends left and right. What I firmly believe is that communism is the utopian vision for society in Western civilization, and that means, you know, both the right and the left. If you asked you know, anyone on all sides of the political spectrum, what does the perfect society look like? And it's and I kind of, you know, address this a little bit in the film with one of the professors who gives you know, that I talk to. But it, you know, it's a society where everyone, you know, can kind of get what they want and pursue the things that interest them. For those on the right, they generally feel, well, that's might be the utopian vision, but it's unattainable. And the left, you know, believes that it's, you know, it is something that we should be striving for. The right, I guess, feels that it's best approximated through free markets and capitalism, and the left, you know, through socialism and greater involvement. But I do think both sides, or all sides, do appreciate the vision. You know, communism is certainly a trigger word, but if you take the word communism out of the equation and you just look at what the ideals are, I do think it's something in Western civilization that everyone does get behind. It's just its attainability or how it can or should even be attempted, if at all. excuse me, but I think it's universal in that way.
And it's interesting, because I really haven't heard the sort of the communist interpretation of Gilligan's Island. Before we get into that, What are some of the sort of common ways people have, you know, analyzed Gilligan's Island? I know there's a lot of different theories out there.
There was one that was sort of prevailing, and it really bothered me because it's, you know, I have an academic background, and it's precisely the opposite of an academic theory, and you know, someone had made some observation that, you know, there are seven castaways and there are seven deadly sins. Therefore, each of the castaways represents one of the seven deadly sins. But the analogs are imperfect. I mean, sure, you can have, you know, the Howells and Greed, but then you have both Howells. So I guess it's just Mr. Howell and Greed. And then, you know, you have Lust, which is Ginger, but then, you know, who's gluttony? Is the skipper gluttony? Well, if the skipper's gluttony, who's anger? And, you know, it all really falls apart and is really imperfectly, you know, ascribed. And then the other problem, you know, which is the biggest problem, is, you know, what are the consequences? If you're saying that they're, you know, that the consequences that they're stuck on this, you know, on the island, well, it's a tropical island paradise, and, you know, that's the consequence of embodying the sin. Are there options, you know, chances for rescue, sabotage because of greed or envy or gluttony? No, you never see that take place. So even if you thought the island was somehow purgatory, so it just fails in every way as a hypothesis, beyond the fact that there are seven and seven. And so I kind of poke fun at that and say, you know, how, well, there are, you know, seven natural wonders of the ancient world. There are seven, you know, fruits in Hawaiian punch, and it's just, you know, it's absurd. But that's the prevailing one. If you ask, you know, someone, oh, what's a theory about Gilligan, and that would be the one they'd throw. And there have been some other analysis. There was some paper I saw once. It looked more promising than the execution, but it was a study. Yeah, it didn't really get very far in terms of distribution. But there was someone who did some analysis of the economics on Gilligan's Island, and periodically things will crop up in there was a book. That's right. There was a that analyzed various different TV shows, Star Trek, Gilligan's Island, and others, by a sociology professor. And he believed that these were, and I totally disagree with his analysis and his thesis, but his thesis was that these shows were all examples of American hegemony, of the United States putting forth its culture out into either the universe in Star Trek or you know, other islands in Gilligan's Island. But in both those examples, and I can't remember the other three, you know, examples that he provided, it's Americans, yes, but the culture of Star Trek, the culture of Gilligan's Island is only marginally representative of American culture. I mean, it's you know, they're both utopian visions of American culture, I suppose, but they're, you know, they sort of cease to be in many ways as well. And he doesn't really acknowledge or address you know, what is transformed. I guess this Hegelian dialectic that, yeah, there's an American component, but it becomes compromised of sorts through this interaction. And that was absent from his work. So I can't really recommend the book for that reason.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I want to get back to that Seven Deadly Sins bit just briefly, because the massive hole for me in that is that, to me, the punchline of Gilligan's Island, at the end of the day, the sort of in-joke, is that they actually like being on the island together. You know, it's sort of, they've gotten away from the proverbial rat race of civilization, and as much as they want to get off the island, there's always that lingering, you know, self-sabotage going on.
Yeah, I mean, there was, when I was going through the show and watching all the episodes multiple times, that there was a certain, I guess, sense that I'm sure it's not there, and I'm sure this is Reed again, but it isn't too hard to believe that they intentionally set Gilligan up to be the scapegoat, that he was intentionally, that they would purposefully give him whatever crucial component that was necessary for the rescue, knowing that Gilligan would bungle it either, and possibly deliberately so, to prevent them, because, you know, subconsciously, or not even subconsciously, but they really didn't want to get off the island, but they didn't have the courage to utter it out loud for fear that the others might actually want to get off the island. So there is this intentional sabotage of the efforts, you know, to make sure that they stay there, because this part is real, is on the island, they all become whole human beings. And that's part of the communist component too, is under capitalism, all but the proletariat, which is Gilligan and Marianne, all of them are defined by their function. They're not human beings. There's a skipper, there's a professor, there's a movie star and a millionaire. They're not people. This is their identity is defined, you know, by their function. You know, they're reduced to you know, what they produce and not who they are. And on the island, they develop and become, you know, full human beings with real identities, and where their actions and labors are directly benefit the community and are necessary for their, you know, communal survival as well. And you know, in particular, you have the pinnacles of success in certainly American culture is, you know, fame, the movie star, fortune, the millionaire, and prestige with being a professor. But all of those become, those are all ultimately unfulfilling pursuits because they don't have the direct connection with others. They aren't, you know, complete full human beings, but they still are able to use those skills. Ginger is able to, use her skills for entertainment, or in some instances to fool nefarious, you know, visitors to the island with her acting skills. And the professor certainly uses his skills to help with the survival. The Howells, again, they're, you know, as chairman of the board, his capacity for organization and, you know, to organize others he becomes a central figure in the benefit of to everyone, as well as, you know, taking on, he does, you know, have to engage in manual labor at times and ultimately finds it rewarding.
Well, yeah, I was going to say it's interesting because in the theme song, you know, the only two characters that are mentioned by name are Gilligan and Marianne. So that sort of plays into that too, because they're the proletariat, they're the working class people.
Yeah, precisely. So, you know, as the working class, they're already named, they're already, you know, whole human beings. And the island isn't the, you know, it could have been the professor's island, it could have been the skipper's island, you know, and the reason it's, yeah, and that's one of those things where you just don't really think about it. You know, why is it Gilligan's island, you know? Why Gilligan? And, you know, it's Gilligan's Island because, you know, it could have been Marianne's Island as well, but Marianne was originally a minor character. And so in the first season, the professor and Marianne aren't even named. They're just, and the rest. And yeah, certainly there was some sexism at the time, but not, but that wouldn't have precluded it from being Marianne's Island because you did have a number of shows at that time with female protagonists. You had Bewitched, you had I Dream of Jeannie, Lucy certainly carried her show as well, and you know, hers had a male protagonist and she was still the dominant, you know, unquestioned dominant figure. So it wouldn't have been impossible for it to be Marianne's Island, but you know, she was, you know, conceived, like I said, as a minor character. So Gilligan, you know, as the representative of the proletariat, and so it's the island of proletariat vision, and the proletariat vision is at least the communist in this instance anyway.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was just thinking about your use of that word. Utopia. It's interesting to me that it takes place on an island because, you know, if we go back to sort of the origins of that term utopia, I think it sort of comes around with Thomas More, who wrote a book called Utopia, which is about a fictional island, you know, that's depicted as the perfect society. So it's kind of interesting to me that it takes place on an island in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this probably I'd have to go through utopian literature, but I would suspect that it's, you know, that an island is probably a fairly common setting because, you know, one can isolate, you know, the society. It removes outside factors, you know, from influencing what takes place. It becomes contained, you know, a self-contained society. And you know, sort of makes stability more sustainable.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because I know there were a few episodes of Gilligan's Island where, you know, every once in a while they'll have you know, these people come to the island and they think that these people are going to save them, but those people often say to them, well, this is paradise, you know, it's a tropical island paradise on its own.
Sometimes most of them are, you know, I mean, pretty much all of the outside forces or figures, you know, are corrupt in some manner. Either, you know, they're nefarious, they're criminals, they're exploiters. Occasionally they're befuddled and lost, and those are the ones who at least appreciate, and then somehow they get lost on their way off the island too. But the overwhelming majority are nefarious figures, and I think that's indicative of how the outside world, which is still capitalistic or Soviet communistic, which is not communism or not Marxist communism. It's just part of the Soviet propaganda to actually call themselves communists when in fact they're actually, you know, the antithesis of. So the outside world is a horrible place. The, you know, when things wash ashore, they tend to be contaminated, which, you know, also plays into not only just that the outside world is corrupt, but also this notion that the storm that shipwrecked them was in fact nuclear war, because the outside world is often radioactive. Either radioactive seeds wash ashore, radioactive meteorite comes, radioactive. There are several scenes, you know, episodes, a number of episodes where radioactive elements from the outside world, you know, threaten their survival quite directly and literally. So there is this notion of the outside world constantly being a threat, and the outside world also, when they're observed, there is this notion that the outside world can't comprehend what they're seeing. If there's a flyover, either they miss them or they misread their SOS message as SOL, Sol, or as a tribute to this one astronaut whose name was Sol there, you know, or lunar lander comes. So there, I mean, it's comedic, but it is sort of indicative of this, of the outside world, of the capitalist or Eastern Bloc a world just not able to identify what communism is and what a communist utopia looks like. It's perverted and tainted by expectations. And I think there's sort of an irony there as well, because I think it plays off, it's sort of meta because it makes fun of the viewer, because most viewers didn't understand, or very few viewers understood what they were really looking at, which is a communist utopia, and few people, you know, really know what communism is and just, you know, buy into, you know, like I said, the Eastern Bloc propaganda definition, and are triggered by the very word. But it does show that, you know, yeah, you're not, you know, they're not getting it and you're laughing at them, you know, the depictions of the comedic, you know, people who view and don't understand what they're looking at, but you as a viewer aren't really getting it either. And I think that's sort of present.
Yeah, in some ways it reminds me of what Kubrick was doing with Dr. Strangelove, where he's almost like making fun of, you know, the Cold War and, you know, the possibility of nuclear annihilation. And with Gilligan, it's sort of looking at all of this stuff and being like, wow, the world outside of this island is actually pretty crazy. Like, we're threatening to destroy each other with nuclear weapons, and you know, we're based on consumption and greed rather than social cooperation. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how Gilligan's Island is sort of in a way a product of its era, and how it's commenting on that, especially the Cold War?
Sure, absolutely. So there was, you know, the film, and it's funny, or the series rather, it's funny how there's a lot of people I talk to, and they really don't know when the series came out, you know, because it's been in reruns for so long, and they sort of remember it from when they saw it. And so everyone seems to have a different sense, but it's so much a product of its time, and yet at the same time, it really survives and persists. And there was tremendous paranoia, and some of it reasonably so. And I tried to actually, you know, show that in the movie, that you know, we laugh today about, you know, the Cold War, and we laugh about, you know, the Soviet threat because, you know, the Soviet Union fell. But it was real, and the Soviet expansionism into Eastern Europe was and into Asia was genuinely and truly a horrible thing, and rightly scary, but profoundly destructive, and a thing to legitimately be feared. It was, you know, truly a horror, and there was this real reasonable appreciation of the possibility that the U.S. and Soviet Union would come to a war, that it was just inevitable, as both were trying to lay claim to their various governments, systems, capitalism, Soviet communism, outside, you know, the realms of their border and you know, the conflicts, and things really did almost, you know, a number of times, you know, nuclear war nearly did happen, and you know, certainly during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but other times too. We keep, you know, learning there are different instances. There was some Soviet nuclear submarine commander who was given, you know, some request to launch, you know, and nuclear missiles, and he didn't. He went against his orders, but you know, it was. The request was made on bad information, but yeah, I mean, there were many times where it could have happened, and so to write it off as paranoia, and you know, there was a movie Atomic Cafe that seems to, you know, make it all seem like it was a big joke, because, you know, the media about it was kind of inept as far as, you know, informing people of the risk, and the threat, and that part was sort of a joke, but people were building bomb shelters. There was in their houses. There were the exercise, the drills, what to do for a nuclear war, and that's, you know, you can laugh at it, but it's the alternative was just to feel helpless, and you know, I suspect that was, you know, not the best approach. It was decided, and so efforts were made to try to at least, you know, give people a sense of agency. We can laugh at that, but it was coming out of something real. But the sense of, well, you know, if there's a nuclear war, there will be survivors. You know, people survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and who were, you know, near ground zero. So it's not unreasonable to think that people would survive. But the question is, well, what happens? What do you do if you survive? And so, you know, the ties between that and then stories like Robinson Crusoe, of the shipwreck that Sherwood Schwartz, the show's creator, grew up on, you know, kind of came together. And so that fear of nuclear war and that sense of you know, surviving on a deserted island, you know, it just became a convenient analog and sort of a way to present this, the way MASH was about the Korean War literally, but everyone knew it was really about Vietnam. You know, it's sort of this cathartic approach to dealing with our fears, legitimate fears or legitimate issues that were, you know, never wounds that hadn't healed. And so it was a way of doing that. But what makes Gilligan's Island unique is that it's the only, and I challenge anyone to find one, it's the only utopian post-apocalyptic world. You know, pretty much every other cinematic and literary depiction of post-apocalypse, you know, it's Mad Max or some kind of horrible thing. This is like, yeah, the nuclear war comes and it's not so bad, you know. It's pretty good.
Well, I was gonna say too, I'm glad you mentioned Sherwood Schwartz, because you actually interview him in the documentary, and I know he talks about a lot of things in that documentary, including sort of the original idea was to make a TV movie about, you know, people that were in a cave and then came out to find a nuclear war and how things sort of evolved from there. I don't want to spoil it too much. I think people should watch the documentary, but could you just talk about Sherwood Schwartz and what you sort of got out of him and his feelings on Gilligan's Island?
So Sherwood Schwartz always intended the show to be political. He didn't have a political background. He was actually had a master's in, I think, biology. Don Wells also had a master's, not in biology, but one of the other sciences. So there was that sort of connection there between the two of them, that they both were sciences, but he did have a sociological vision, which is why everyone, all the characters are taken from different walks of society. You know, you have, you know, this, you know, all the people from different classes, and he said, yeah, if it were done today, it would have, you know, there would have been a multiracial. But this was the early 60s, and that was, you know, that wasn't, you know, the modus operandi at the time. And the vision was, you know, how do these people, you know, from all walks of life who are forced to confront one another, you know, how do they get along? How do they survive? And what is it, you know, that enables everyone to get along? Because, you know, ultimately, you know, we're social creatures and we all have to get along. It enabled, you know, this, and it was intentional and unintentional at the same time, that communism, you know, emerged as the answer. And it was, you know, the only way. The amazing thing is the conflicts in the episodes, and in many of the episodes, is that some vestige of democratic capitalism rears its ugly head, destabilizes society, causes conflicts that can only be resolved by the end, where they're purged and communism, you know, returns and prevails and stability and harmony resume. And so they experiment with all sorts of different features of you know, that we've come to know and celebrate, you know, in our democratic society. They flirt with an executive branch. They decide they need leadership. Whereas true communism, again, not Soviet communism, there is no government in true communism. And so they have no government, but they're aware that, hey, we have no government. We need a government, but it's not born out of any kind of necessity. It's only born out of this appreciation of something that they don't have that they're used to. And this again speaks to, you know, why this isn't American, you know, hegemony. I have to look up the name of that author. You know, so they elect a president, and when they, you know, and Gilligan wins, you know, in some comic state of affairs. And the funny thing was, you know, they show Gilligan, who's this character in this particular episode, who's incapable of even tying his own shoelaces, and yet he's elected president as a write-in candidate, and they all accept the social contract. Well, if he's president, you know, we have to accept and abide that, even if their own survival is, I mean, literal survival can be jeopardized by someone who is, again, so completely inept that he can't tie his shoelaces, and now he's the one making, you know, the decisions for how to allocate scarce resources and how to, you know, build a well and you know, all sorts of, you know, the very basics of their survival. are governed and ruled by this person that's, you know, presented as profoundly incompetent, but the democratic social contract, like I said, insists that they have to abide by the rules of the election, which is completely absurd. And it's funny. So when I was, you know, making, you know, doing that editing, W. Bush was president, and I was like, oh wow, this is so prescient. And now, you know, people still say, oh, did you know that, you know, our current, you know, presidency, that this would be, you know, so, you know, continue to be so accurate and. You know, so there are some things that just really persist. But naturally, so they create this executive branch, and everyone on the island wants a position in the cabinet, because if they get a position, they won't have to work. If they're Secretary of Labor, you know, they can just lounge with the title. And that says a great deal about our democratic system as well, that if you want to avoid having to do anything, you get a position in government. So everyone stops working because they all get, you know, positions in the government, and chaos ensues. And then the same thing happens with a justice system and a legal system where, again, these, you know, they're, it's not born out of any legitimate need. It's just born on, hey, we don't have laws. And we have to have law and order on the island, so they start having laws. And before long, everyone is arrested for violating, you know, these trivial laws that have no meaning or purpose or function on the island. And, you know, then they miss an opportunity to be rescued because they're all in some island jail, or they have a justice system. And there's this philosopher, Ivan Ilyich, who says that the institutions create the problems that they're designed to solve. So here they create a justice system that's supposed to solve disputes, but instead, within 10 minutes of creating a justice system, everyone on the island is suing one another. So you clearly see how the institution created the problem that it was designed to solve, which was, you know, the resolution of disputes, but instead it exacerbates and magnifies those problems, and it's, you know, it's wonderfully comical, you know, it's hilarious, but at the same time it's just skewering, you know, the American democratic systems that we, you know, hold so dear.
Yeah, that's the episode where I believe Gilligan becomes deputy, you know, to Skipper's sheriff, and he becomes drunk with power, and he just arrests everyone and throws them in jail.
Yeah, that one. And then there's a one where Gilligan discovers a treasure chest, or might be a treasure chest, and there's a dispute as to whether he owns it or whether Mr. Howell, who had asked him to do some digging, whether Howell owned it. And so they have a court to decide who owns it. And at that point, the professor rules, no, everything is community property on the island because we're communists, you know. So no one owns anything. We all own everything. So, you know, it couldn't have been any clearer at that point. And the amazing thing is, back then, there usually wasn't much memory. Every episode of sitcoms tended to be an isolated episode where if something would happen in the next episode, there would never be any reference to it. That episode is actually referred to, where they find a gold mine on the island, you know, many episodes later. And Gilligan said, hey, remember, we all decided everything on the island is owned by everyone. So there is actually that it's rare, profoundly rare. I can't think of another example until, you know, the 70s or maybe early 80s, where you had memory of previous episodes, because, you know, you'd have different writers and, you know, it was just sort of convenient not to have to do that. But there, the communist nature was, you know, was set in stone and was referred to in future episodes.
Well, it's a really groundbreaking sitcom in so many ways. And it's, as you said, Schwartz sort of intended it to be political, but I would go even farther. I think it's a very subversive show, and it almost boggles my mind that it's the same guy that helped create the Brady Bunch, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Brady Bunch was, you know, I guess groundbreaking in different ways. not the same. It's not a political show, but you do have blended families, which I guess you later had with Courtship of Eddie's Father, not blended, but you started playing around with family units and things like that. But you had a man and a woman whose spouse, maybe they were, I think the subtext, everyone knew they were divorced, even if, I think there might have been an allusion at one point that Carol's husband died or something like
that.
They
never slept in the same bed.
No, they did. They were in the same
okay,
bed.
Okay, okay, okay.
Yeah, no, they were in the same bed. But
I'm misremembering things.
but it was, it was a way of dealing with divorce when divorce wasn't spoken about. It wasn't addressed in the series either. So it was, it wasn't quite Norman Lear, but it was, certainly pushing things a little bit that way. And certainly not like Gilligan, which really pushed things, but pushed things without anyone really realizing just how radical and insane that show was to celebrate communism.
Yeah, I think a lot of people miss what was going on beneath the surface with Gilligan's Island, as your documentary shows. One thing I wanted to get back to was the you've referenced how Marxist communism or Marx's conceptualization of communism is very different from Soviet communism. And I think a lot of it can be summed up in that sort of heuristic phrase, to each according to his ability, to each according to his need, which I think a lot of people, when I bring that quote up, people don't really understand what it means. And that phrase becomes very central to what you talk about in the movie and sort of illustrates the difference between Soviet communism and, Marx's idea of communism.
Yeah, there are just no comparisons between the two. I mean, communism, Marxist communism is anarchistic. Soviet communism, you have, what is essentially a dictatorship, there's clearly, a government, an incredibly oppressive one. The government owns, the means of production, and the government decides how everything is allocated in the Soviet system. That's all worked out among the population and Marxist communists. To each according from each according to their ability. It means the things that you're best at are the things that you engage in, and that you work on the things that you're best at to produce. The things that you receive. And so the Howells, the life of if you look at the huts, for instance, the Howells live in a much nicer hut. They sleep in beds, whereas Gilligan and the Skipper sleep in hammocks. And that's a perfect example of teach according to their needs. Yeah, the Howells are slightly older. They're used to a certain lifestyle. That doesn't violate communism, that the Howells should have a nicer hut, because the Skipper and Gilligan, they don't need much. What are their needs? They're fine with the hammock. Those discrepancies. You don't need to have, perfect equal distribution. That's not what Marxist communism is about. So there doesn't have to be that perfect distribution. It's again, what do you need? The Howells had somewhat different needs, and that was okay. There were no jealousies over that ever. It was never highlighted or brought up. It just was what it was. And again, I'm not saying this is attainable or that was how things would really work in the real world or anything like that. But as a depiction, as a fair depiction of how communism operates, true communism, it does provide an accurate representation.
Well, I still think that concept, in some ways, I think it's a concept that I think most people can agree with when you explain it to them. Like, there's this idea, I think, that people would like to agree with that, we can each contribute to society in our own way. you know, some of us will be able to do one thing, another may be able to do another thing. Some people may have issues that disable them from doing one type of function in that society, but they can do another function. And we all sort of work together, and it's not sort of based on greed. That sort of gets back to that idea of utopia, and I think Gilligan's Island really illustrates that quite well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fundamental tenets of communism, you know, no government. Again, that's the opposite. You have no ownership of property. Certainly in you know, the Soviet, you know, communism, there's clearly ownership, and the inner party, the, you know, the Politburo and such, you know, have preferential treatment when it comes to that property. No religion is a fundamental feature, and I think sort of the cult of Lenin or Stalin is, you know, could be quasi, you know, defined as quasi religious to a certain degree. You know, that Orwellian Big Brother is certainly, you know, a surrogate for religion in some way. There was no religion for the most part on television, so, you know, and it's really hard to discuss the absence of something. So it was hard to go into that too much other than to say, yeah, there's no religion, and then move on. There is classlessness of society. There's certainly that's certainly not the case in you know, the Eastern Bloc. The party members were certainly of an upper echelon, but there was no class distinction between between the Howells and you know, it was quite the opposite. They had to roll up their sleeves and work. And then, you know, like you mentioned, yeah, working according to your ability everyone had to pitch in and cook, clean, do the laundry, do the manual labor, whatever was required, collecting food. To survive.
Well, it's interesting too, because I think there's that temptation to just look at the Howells and be like, oh, they must be the show's evil capitalist exploiters. But you, as you sort of point out, you don't necessarily agree with that, and in some ways, you sort of even see some humanity in the Howells at certain points that show they're not just these exploitative people. I remember in the, I know this is not the TV series, but in the movie, Rescue from Gilligan's Island, when Gilligan and Skipper go to see the Howells, once they're off the island, all the rich friends of the Howells are sort of making fun of Gilligan and Skipper, and they kick out, you know, all the other rich people for making fun of their friends.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak too much of the movies, because I kind of found that the movies sort of undermined everything that was in the series. They end up, you know, the island ends up becoming a resort, which, you know, and that would tie into the hegemony theory, you know, where it becomes a capitalist place, and they, you know, destination, and they all become, you know, enslaved to you know, the guests of, you know, whoever comes and visits. So, yeah, I don't really think much of the movies, but the Howells definitely become, you know, he might try to put on some veneer of being cold, but he'll always. There are many episodes where, you know, he will where Mr. Howell clearly, you know, goes against his I don't want to say training, but you know, the traditional approach of what would be best in a capitalist society of looking out for number one, where he does you know, try hard to help others, and is respected and appreciated. They think he's fallen in quicksand and died, and they see his hat, and they just, the rest of the castaways have this real tearful, you know, funeral for him, and you know, you get to see at that moment just how much he's touched everyone.
Well, it's interesting to me, because what I think is so appealing to so many people all these years later, about Gilligan's Island is, you know, it takes the emphasis away from, you know, the obsessions of a material rat race sort of consumer society, and says maybe it would be better if we focused more on our social relations. You know, that's sort of what makes the people on the island happy, the castaways.
And that's precisely what Sherwood Schwartz had explicitly intended in his pitch meeting to CBS when he was trying to sell the series. And that was actually a big turnoff for them, because they didn't, they just wanted something that was entertaining. And one of the people at CBS had asked if Gilligan could have a pet dinosaur. and Sherwood just, kind of left the meeting banging his head, and it might have happened too if it weren't for the expense of trying to create such a thing. The whole background story of how the show got made is fascinating. Because there's some hidden stuff in it. So, for instance, the boat was called the SS Minnow, which was named after Newton Minnow. And Newton Minnow was the chair of the FCC. And Newton Minnow had just given this speech about how television had become this vast wasteland. And was deliberately changed the power structure. So prior to the early 60s, when Gilligan came out, shows were directly sponsored by industry, by companies. Westinghouse and GE and others would finance whatever television show or series that they thought was best. And Newton Minnow came along and took it out of their hands and placed it in the hands of the networks. Well, there were only three networks. So it was became, where it was more democratic of sorts in terms of who you pitch to. And certainly, there's going to be, the companies are going to have various concerns over what's going to best represent their brand. But now you've only got three places to pitch your show to, because there were only three networks at the time, CBS, NBC, and ABC. So it made it a much harder prospect, and you're dealing with the whims of people who were executives who knew even less about what should be on television than perhaps the corporate world. So when the ship was wrecked, he was wrecked on this wasteland of an island, he was saying, no, it's Newton Minnow that's actually manufactured this wasteland and has, and so it was an act of violence by wrecking the SS Minnow.
Well, it's interesting, since you mentioned again that there's sort of a critique of democracy in Gilligan's Island, although I think when we say democracy, we're talking more about democratic capitalism. At least that's the impression I got in the documentary, is that in the system we currently have, it ends up being not very democratic. And we see that in Gilligan's Island when they try to enforce these sort of ideals of democratic capitalism, but it turns into things like bribery, happening and whatnot. It becomes very anti-democratic in a way.
Well, the bribery is attempted when they invoke, everyone tries to do their, whatever skill they have when the system becomes capitalistic, when they have an election, then it's open to bribery, because, it's when those principles. But bribery has no meaning when money has no meaning. So you can't have bribery when you have communism. It's only when you have the court system, and then you want to bribe the judge. It's only when the institutions are created that they open themselves up to being seduced by Ginger, Marianne might offer a banana cream pie or whatever, something to tilt it when you have an institution. But it's, their communism just isn't susceptible to that kind of influence.
Yeah, it's not susceptible to this sort of the social status power hierarchy game.
Yeah. And again, that doesn't, you know, that's it's utopian, you know, but it's, yeah, but that's the, you know, the vision. That's how it would work and function, at least.
Well, you know, there were just maybe one or two more threads I wanted to get on. A big aspect of the documentary is the concept of alienation and how it relates to Gilligan's Island. Could you talk a little bit for my listeners that may be unfamiliar about what Marx's concept of alienation was and how it ties into Gilligan's?
Sure. So I mean, alienation can take, you know, multiple forms, but there's alienation from one's labor is certainly one of the more prevalent one, and that is that the worker creates a product that she or he doesn't own. And so their labor is paid for as well. You know, and their labor is bargained and bought and sold. So that's certainly one form of alienation. There's, you know, alienation from oneself. There's alienation from, you know, you can be alienated from pretty much, you know, anything. But when you have a direct connection, you know, if you own the means of production and the product that you create, you know, people who are self-employed are not alienated from their labor, and then they can barter their you know, what they've created freely. So on Gilligan's Island, you know, in the communist society, everyone has a direct relationship with you know, the, you know, themselves as full realized people and the commodities that they create. You know, whatever they be.
And just out of curiosity, are there any favorite episodes that you have that sort of deal with the political underpinnings that you would you know, recommend to listeners, maybe?
Yeah. So I have many favorite episodes. The best one, and you'll forgive me if I just don't remember the titles of the episodes, but there was one where some film equipment washes ashore, and they have to and they decide it's just silent movie gear. You know, there's no sound, but they decide to make a movie that you know, shows how they were shipwrecked and you know, makes an appeal for their rescue. But they make a dramatic, you know, film of it, you know, sort of, you know, in the style of the silent movies of the 20s. And, you know, of course, you know, because they're, you know, they're amateurs, if filmmakers, you know, they're and Gilligan is, of course, involved with his, you know, questionable skill set. You know, the film, you know, has all sorts of, you know, haphazard moments and errors, and, you know, Gilligan, you know, affected the when they were in the dark room developing and stuff. And anyway, the film is both chaotic and absolutely brilliant and hilarious, and they put it on a raft, and it, you know, somehow makes its way to Paris, where it gets entered in the Cannes Film Festival and wins, you know, the main, you know, prize there. And, you know, no one recognizes or realizes it's, you know, these people who had been lost at sea. But, you know, and then the review of their film is just, you know, hilarious about, you know, all the mistakes, of course, they think were intentional, as they would or should think that, you know, given that was what was submitted. You know, it's just hilarious. There's another great episode where they they stage a musical version of Hamlet, which is just genius. I always like the one where the mosquitoes, who are this analog for the Beatles, you know, come on the island, and that one's pretty funny too. So yeah, they're really a lot of great episodes, and some of the writing is pretty solid. President Gilligan might have some of the best writing Yeah, the one where Gilligan gets elected president. So yeah, I mean there are a lot of really really I mean a lot of the humor really does stand up. And one thing that was interesting. So I was going through and I was looking at all the reviews, not just the reviews at the time, you know, when the show was sort of, you know, savagely attacked by critics, not universally. There was a percentage that did enjoy the show at the time. So I think there was something that's, you know, where you know, people remembered as everyone hating it. And that wasn't true. But there was a lot of behind the scenes tension and stuff among you know, the executive producer and Sherwood Schwartz and CBS and
Tina Louise, right? The ginger. Tina Louise had a lot of problems on set.
That's among the actors, and that's sort of okay. Different. I'm talking about the on the executive production side.
Okay. Yeah.
And so all these different people actually, you know, did come out with books. And one thing that was universal in all of these books is everyone praise the actors. You know, what people might have, you know, complained, you know, some, you know, thought the scripts were terrible, some didn't, but everyone universally recognized that the actors on the show were really professional and remarkable, and that was absolutely correct. They were truly amazing actors, and you know, who really cared about their craft and really delivered, and it is the acting that ends up making the show, you know, what it is to a great degree. When I talked to them about one another, they all had great love for one another. For whatever, you know, whatever conflicts that Ginger, you know, that Tina Louise may have had at the time. When I talked to Russell Johnson and Don Wells, they had nothing but love for her and nothing but good things to say. And they understood, you know, where she was coming from with stuff. You know, the show, you know, at that time, it's a shame that they didn't have the foresight, you know, sight that they have today, that any exposure is good. But in those days, you know, there was something that they thought was typecasting. And she had a real promising career that was sort of derailed by Gilligan. Her agent had told her she was going to be the star of the show, and so she had to struggle with that, and that's unfortunate. And like I said, the other actors were very sympathetic to that.
Well, yeah, I was going to say I really enjoyed the interviews that were included in the documentary with Don Wells, Marianne, and
Russell Johnson.
Russell Johnson, the professor, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't go into, you know, into the personal side of things. You know, that's all on the tapes that I have, but it didn't relate directly to the to the discussion. So unfortunately it didn't make it to the movie, because the movie was focusing on the political message and not so much, you know, the making of and the story behind.
I was gonna say, you know, I understand your emphasis on you know, it is a utopian vision. You're not necessarily saying that the vision in Gilligan's Island is a practical one. But are there any valuable lessons that you think we can learn from Gilligan's Island, or anything about the sort of utopian vision that has contributed to its ongoing staying power in the cultural mind?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think just because something, you know, we need ideals. And I think there's a whole debate over that that's sort of taking place right now over, you know, the Green New Deal thing. I think, you know, there is the question of, you know, is this meant to be, you know, a concrete plan, or is this meant to be, you know, an ideal? Well, actually, it's not really being discussed as an ideal, but as an ideal, it's a wonderful thing. And I think in the challenges to it, I think that's sort of being lost. You know, we need to know what we want to strive for, because it defines who we are. If we all believe that we should be living in a just, fair society, it means that if we fall short from that, you know, even if we can't achieve perfection, we know when we've derailed. And if we just say, you know, we don't really have any ideals because that's just utopian, you know, then it impacts and affects you know, when we fall short of, you know, when things go awry because we just don't notice, we don't care. It's very important to know what we stand for and what it is we want, regardless of its attainability. And we need to know that things are ideal. We need to be aware that ideals are ideals because, you know, I think, yeah, you can fall into the trap of the worst consequences can happen of a dictatorship if you believe in so firmly and strongly that ideals are attainable. But if you acknowledge that these are the things that we want to attain but are not attainable, then at least you can and should work towards them. And I think that's very, very important. It's really important to know what you believe in, what you stand for, and to explicitly state it. If it's not stated, you can't work towards it, and that kind of cynicism, I don't think, you know, gets you anywhere. I think it really undermines any kind of efforts to improve society, to improve, you know, how people get along, and to regresses from attempts at a just society.
Well, it's I mean, what for me makes Gilligan such a standout show is especially today, a lot of, you know, TV sitcoms or, you know, shows like maybe like Family Guy as an example, they have this sort of a cynical, even borderline nihilistic attitude towards social relations and things of that sort, you know, where everything's sort of just seen as, you know, I need to get the bigger car, the best wife, this, that, and the other thing. Whereas on Gilligan's Island, I think it's sort of heartwarming to see a show that sort of embraces the ideal of treating everyone with like a very basic human dignity and sort of cooperating together. And I think as an ideal, you know, that's a good one to hold, even if we can't get to the utopian endpoint.
Yeah, I wouldn't be completely dismissive of Family Guy and South Park. I think satire comes from, you know, that there is a place of moral centeredness in order for you to make fun of other things. So I will offer some kind of defense there, but at the same time, I think it does take a profoundly great deal more courage to put forth something constructive and to risk that and satire can be, yeah, as you noted, you're coming from a certain position when you satire something, but it can be broad and not as focused, you know, as something very specific that you see in Gilligan.
Well, I guess I always like to end, as I say, on a positive note. So what do you want to say maybe about the role of Gilligan's Island in pop culture and why it has, you know, really stayed with us for such a long time? I mean, there is, as you said, sort of a memory that has been dredged up that in its time it wasn't really considered a great show. But I mean, now it's a pop culture landmark.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's the fantasy. I think, you know, it's who wouldn't want to, you know, live on Gilligan's Island and be in that kind of in environment. And I think that really speaks to the basic things, you know, that we all want. It is, you know, it is, as you brought up alienation, it's the antithesis of alienation. You have this direct, you know, if you're living on the island, you know, you have a direct connection with all the people on the island, and you know, you get to, there was an episode where there's a dictator comes to the island, and he because he's a dictator, all he knows is how to be a dictator, and he tries to take over the island. He's deposed there by his people. You know, he's just abandoned and to what they think is, you know, a deserted island. And when his government is overthrown. So he tries to take over, and his takeover fails, and Mrs. Howell, explains to him, because he's like, well, what's gonna happen to me? Am I gonna be executed? And he's like, no, you're gonna become like one of us. You'll get to pursue the things that you want to pursue. You'll get to to live among us and be a member of functioning and contributing member of society. And he's like, and he says, oh, you mean I become one of the masses? it's very funny. And she's like, well, we don't like to see ourselves that way. and this is Mrs. Howell, but concedes. Yeah. They're all one of the masses, but I mean, it's the masses, it's only seven people, but it's, they have real intimate connections with one another, and they get to develop themselves as whole human beings, and they get to pursue the things, that interest them, obviously with the constrictions of, the everyday needs of survival. That's always going to be prevail, that Maslow hierarchy, but there is, the opportunity to for self-actualization. And that's ultimately what's so appealing is that human connection to others and the capacity to develop oneself and to develop oneself in ways that are meaningful, not to just oneself, but to others as well.
Well, I was going to say, I think Mrs. Howell in that episode even says, you'll be free to be who you want to be, right? So, I mean, there's that element of human freedom that goes into it, too.
That's central. That's it. It's about freedom.
Well, we've gone the whole interview without asking the sort of question that always comes up whenever you have a discussion, at least whenever I've had a discussion about Gilligan's Island. So I'm going to ask it. I know it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but Marianne or Ginger?
you got to realize I interviewed Marianne. I talked to Ginger, to Tina Louise, and she actually had seen The War on Kids in theaters, and she said, I will happily work with you on projects. She's very big into to youth rights and doing things for kids, but she said, but I just can't do anything with Gilligan's Island. That said, she was planning on coming to the premiere, but Marianne, I'm Marianne.
Well, it's funny too, because I've always read that so Ginger is the glitzy glamour, and Dawn Wells as Marianne is sort of the down to earth girl next door, almost sweetheart. But it's funny because and I don't know if it was Sherwood Shorts that said this, but he said that there was always more fan mail for Marianne than Ginger, even though a lot of people would try to say, oh, Ginger was the girl that every guy would want. So that almost plays into the the working class thing there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things it can play in to discuss. I don't remember. I didn't ask him about about the fan mail or the one or the other. It's certainly possible. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Used. Real quick, maybe is there anything positive you want to throw out there to my listeners, with regards to maybe people that want to get into film or people that are just interested in these topics, and also just a chance to plug your future work?
Sure. Well, I mean, getting into film is happily the film is I think the last meritocratic industry out there, there are others that used to be, and it's so sad that they require classes and things like that before you can get in film. You start out at the bottom, but if you're reliable and a likable person, you will move up, if you're motivated and interested. People only care about your skills and your and if you're personable. So film is real easy. You start, like I said, as a PA, but you can, and will move up. As far as future projects, the ones I'm working on right now is I'm doing an animated series on education to really drive home all the different points of why compulsory schooling is ineffective and and really fundamentally destructive in a whole bunch of shorts, a series of animated shorts that really explain the points briefly and concisely. And then I'm working on this new film, which will take a few years to get done. And that one is, it's called The Summer of Hate, and it's about the summer of 1966, and it deals with just sort of the crumbling of the fabric of the United States, all while the Beatles are touring the U.S. and the backlash against the Beatles at that time, all the death threats and bomb threats and the KKK rallies and the record burnings that were taking place during that tour, and all while you're seeing sort of the first emergence of really high profile serial killers with Richard Speck and then the shooter at the University of Texas Tower that summer, Vietnam rallies are just anti-war rallies are just starting. There were race riots in different cities just about every week during that summer. That just lasted for days and got fairly violent. It was a real interesting, messed up time.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. I'll have to have you back on when those documentaries come out. God willing, the podcast Parallax Views is still around, maybe in another incarnation. I just want to thank you again so much for giving so much time to do this interview, this conversation. I really appreciate it. Thank you again, Kevin Soling, for coming on Parallax Views.
My pleasure, and I really appreciate the interest, and thank you.
Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.